Welcome to, once again, Food Conversations on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shuswap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Food Conversations is a program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to eating, and with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shuswap. Today, I am very happy to welcome back my guests from last week, two extraordinary people who have set up a farm and a brewery just outside Salmon Arm in another community called Sorrento. Brian McIsaac and Rebecca Neen, a couple of wanderers who wandered all over the world and then ended up in Sorrento, buying a farm with Rebecca's parents. These two individuals have brought collective wisdom that they've gathered from, in the case of Brian, the culture of Ireland and the country itself, and the case of Rebecca, a world of farming that her parents engaged in because they believed they needed to find out what farming was all about. Not many people do that these days. They don't plunge in without taking a course, but because of their intelligence and information about the world, they managed to bring it off with great success. Rebecca and Brian, good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
It's lovely to have you back again. Today we're going to talk not about the trajectory that brought the two of you to start up the operation in Sorrento called Leftfield Farm and Cranach Ales, but to talk a little bit about the farm itself, the concepts that underlie it, and the principles that you operate the farm under. Because I really think listeners will hear a lot from you that solidifies the notion of what food sovereignty, community, relationship, and operating according to principles that are not just profit-oriented, but are oriented towards establishing what we're calling food sovereignty, giving the community some control, not over just the availability of food, but also about the kind of food and the kind of people who produce their food. Before we get into that, though, I think it's important that, Rebecca, you give us a land acknowledgement that is the kind of land acknowledgement that I think we all need to hear and use. So, Rebecca, maybe you could step in and do that.
Sure. So Brian and I were raised in Mi'kmaq, that's where I came from, and Stolo territories for Brian, and of course also the unceded territory of Northern Ireland. We now live in unceded, that means stolen, Secwepemc territory. We are deeply thankful to all of the ancestors who've cared for this land. They showed us a way to live in harmony with it. We're also very grateful to all of those who now live to protect this land from the ongoing depredations of capitalist and colonialist society. This gives us a roadmap for the work that we need to do as to be inhabitants of this place in a solid, in a good way. So we commit ourselves to uphold these teachings to the best of our abilities, to feed the land that feeds us, and to continue to dismantle racist and predatory capitalism that keeps trying to destroy this territory. This includes for us deepening our understanding of the privileges given to us, especially around the equity that we have from, quote unquote, owning stolen land. We are very grateful to be here now on unceded Secwepemc territory.
Well, I think we can just end the show right there. I think you've summed up all the principles that most of us should be living by. Thank you. Thank you very much, Rebecca. I think that's a kind of landed acknowledgement that kind of tells it like it is and incorporates, from what I know of Indigenous experience, the very essence of what has happened over the last 150 years in this part of the world and in many other parts of the world as well. And Brian, in our last show, you mentioned that Ireland was Britain's first colony. And yeah. I think that's an important principle, too.
Yeah, it's definitely the proving ground. I just wanted to break into something about when people do the land acknowledgements, it seems to be just a a set of words, and we like to make sure that there's actionable kinds of things that happen beyond that and how we're actually going to press those kind of things forward. And I'd just like to give an example regarding Sun Peaks. We don't have our beer up there. We've been asked many times to have our beer up there, but of course they're a really good example of neo-colonialist values that are up there. And because we're talking about food sovereignty, we are making sure that we don't support people's enemies for the ideas that was food gathering land for the Shkwepna nation. And so we wouldn't feel right about saying that we are in solidarity with these people and thereby damaging land and further positivity towards what's going on.
It sounds to me like you're talking about something that is usually used, a phrase that's used in a different context, and that is value-added production. Value-added production typically means you take raw material and you put sort of human ingenuity and technology into it, and you create a more theoretically sophisticated product, which then can be sold in the market for a higher price. In other words, you sell raw logs to Japan, and they sell us back toothpicks for a markedly increased price. But what you're talking about, and I think it's important just to underline this, is about selling things with personal and social values embedded in them, so that they're not simply a product that is being used as a material tool. It's also a representation of a certain way of looking at the world. And maybe that's what we need to focus on now with respect to the farm and the brewery, because it's also an enterprise that embodies certain kinds of values. The value that we talked about before the show was an Irish word, galore. And galore, with an E on the end of it, means lots. But in Irish, it doesn't mean lots at all. Brian, could you give us a little linguistic background, etymological background?
Sure. Well, galore in Irish, without the E, is, so it's a borrowed word in English. So it means enough. And the idea to have enough is just the most amazing thing when your standard of living is lower and you really live for sustenance. You don't live for bounty, the way it's got transcribed or translated, I should say, to North America. So the idea of having enough is just amazing. And living beyond that is just is abhorrent to people, and to have more than other people is just a concept that is a new world concept almost, or at least a class concept that people have in Europe and around the world. But just to make sure that you have enough and that everybody around you has enough is important.
So it has a social dimension as well as a personal dimension, is what you're saying?
Yeah, it can't be out of context with the community.
The term that I was thinking of with respect to enough, because enough can say, you know, somebody says to you, enough already, I've had I don't want to do this anymore. But what you're talking about, it seems to me, is mostly about having sufficient, enough to accomplish the goals that you wish to in your personal life and to help the, and that interesting aspect of had enough to be able to help other people, to give to other people.
Yeah, we have a saying in, it's a maglor, means good enough, or cart galore, right enough.
Yes.
And it's used constantly, and people say, okay, we're sorted.
Yes. Things have been settled. We're good now. So after wandering to various other parts of the world, the two of you ended up in Sorrento on land purchased in conjunction with your parents, Rebecca Brewster and Kathleen Neen, themselves knowledgeable, experienced, and well-informed citizens of the planet, both involved in food and other kinds of aspects of society, food systems. You came here, just maybe talk a little bit about how it was this farm as opposed to any other farm that you could have landed on.
Okay. Well, part of it, the reason we fell in love with this area is because it does have, or did have at that point too, a very strong organic farming community. So there were lots of people that we could join in community with fairly quickly. So that was a huge resource. This land echoes for both of us to some extent the land where our hearts live. Interspersion of lakes and rivers and the kind of greenery, the rolling hills, this sort of feels like home for both of us. And you know, there's the sort of pragmatic aspect that this particular piece of land came up at the right time. It was a price that we could manage. It's a lovely spot. There was lots of scope to it, and there were quite a few buildings that were already there that actually we could work with kind of right away without sure. having to build quite so much. And I think most importantly for the brewery aspect of things was the water. So
sure. yeah, there was enough of the water, and it was the same. It was the makeup I needed to put together the old world style recipes that I put together. The hard water without being with free calcium instead of solid calcium that blesses this particular part of the world.
So is calcium involved important in some ways for beer, for making beer?
For our beer, because it's because of the hardness of it that we can do the darker beers that have acidic malted grain within it. And so I couldn't make the same recipes with soft water. And that's why we always, when people talk about getting us on city water, or we refuse it outright because it would change the whole nature of what we're doing here.
Beer lovers listening to this show, be known that you are going to drink beer that will have a special cachet because of the water that is used to make it. I just learned something right now today from you. Thank you.
That's all. You don't have to learn anything more today. You've filled your quota.
I have. I'm up to date. The brewery and the farm are a unit, and the brewery was established for a particular reason on this farm. Maybe Rebecca and Brian, you could both explain why that is done that way.
Well, the basic principle when we started, we knew that small farms, and certainly during the establishment phase, really need some outside income to make them work. Normally, people do that. And actually, I shouldn't say just small farms, because pretty much all farms of any size in Canada are supplemented by off-farm income. And often, Indeed. Actually, even the biggest industrial farms are heavily supplemented. There's not very many places where somebody doesn't have some other job to help with the bills. So knowing that, we really thought it would be prudent to provide ourselves with some off-farm employment. But of course, the minute you step off the farm, you're away from the land and you're removing your attention from what you're doing and limiting your ability to be effective. And to actually really understand your land. So we decided that keeping our off-farm employment, as it were, on the farm made both economic and sociological and farming sense. So putting the brewery on the farm provided us with year-round income, some, we thought, stability, although at this point it turns out the farm's way more stable than the brewery because, hey, there's no hospitality sector. But anyway, that was unforeseen.
However, your beer is available at the all-organic market at Askew's Uptown in the plaza soon every week and now still every second week. So that's Absolutely. For listeners to know.
Yes.
I just wanted to put a little finer point on that year-round employment, because – farming is usually seasonal, as long as you're just doing vegetables. I mean, animals can extend that. But normally, if we were just doing a market garden, and we did start with some of that as well, we have to make sure that whatever market is stronger at the time takes over. The percentages of beer this year is a good example of that, and that went down in volume, and so that we decided to do a little bit more of the farm part of things.
So a principle that underlies the way the farm is constructed is to have enough, sufficient. And that means that you also have to incorporate other notions, one of which is that instead of buying brand new everything, you look around for stuff that's been tested, used, and proven, and worthy of incorporating into your business operation. Let's talk a little bit about the main brewery equipment that you use and have used for 21 years. Tell us about that, Brian.
Well, it's interesting because startups for breweries, like you say, they're quite expensive, but they don't have to be. And that's
how much would a typical brewery cost if you were starting from scratch, if you bought everything new?
Today versus back when we first started, we were told it was $750,000 to put together one. Today, I wouldn't even hazard a guess. I would say we're looking at closer to $2 million.
Lord.
To put that together, and that includes everything, and a lot of stuff that you really don't need as well. And when we were shopping around, we just happened upon some equipment that came from Horseshoe Bay Brewing, and it was really interesting because that's all English, old English steel, and that was put together. They had their operation started in 1982, and so and that was used equipment. Some of it was dairy equipment that they had used, but we'd scooped that up for a song, really, and we were able to just tweak that equipment to make it a little bit more usable for our particular application. And it's really interesting because the steel that made back then was a lot more nickel content, which is easier to sanitize and easier to keep clean. It scratches less, and it's more durable. And it's when you have stainless steel, if it's good stainless steel, it's a forever thing.
That's an interesting concept right there, the concept of durability. When you're using materials or equipment that's being used elsewhere, you would automatically look for stuff that had durability built into it. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely, yes.
You have a Kubota on the farm.
Yes, we do.
Also used.
Yeah, it was 14 years old when we bought it, and 21 years later, it's still going strong. And that's, again, the value of a really, really good small farm tractor.
I wonder how many years of tractor life there is for one human year equivalent. At this rate, this could be an eternal...
last us.
I think tractor years are longer than human years. Is that right? Yes.
Yes, there may be a tractor from the Assyrian Empire awaiting us somewhere. We just don't know it's there. The other thing is, it also calls on employing ingenuity in improvising and maybe even making up equipment. And you told me before the show about your keg cleaner. Tell us about your imaginative keg cleaner.
Well, it's really interesting because we were shopping around for something to do our kegs, and we didn't want to rely on other breweries to do that because that'd be far distance away to get those sorted out. And then we looked into the price of getting a keg cleaner, and they were just out of this world, just atmospheric priced. And so we basically cobbled together one with the help of this super engineer guy who's a plumber, Blair Miller, actually, he's out of the area right now, but he was he cobbled together this thing out of old kegs and PVC for around $600. And most of that actually was the pump itself, the raw materials to make the thing, and just a little bit of his labor. He didn't gouge us for that. And right now, how much are they now? Do you figure?
We had to, sadly, at some point, we had to replace it. So a couple of years ago, we bought a new keg cleaner for $25,000.
And the 600 versus 25,000 is a reasonable disparity in price. It just goes to show you what ingenuity and cleverness and experience can do. And in fact, obviously, that's been a keynote concept with respect to the farm and the brewery to use ingenuity. That's the that's another form of value added, you might say, is use local ingenuity, local skills. Which is part of also the process of becoming part of a community. When you first came to Sorrento, it's a sleepy retirement community in South Central British Columbia, pretty much conventional with respect to how one does one's life. And you brought in concepts like the concept of galore, like the concept of not expanding exponentially as the capitalist, standard capitalist model would suggest. How did that go as you got to know people in the community over the years, bringing those concepts in?
I think at first people just, I don't have to think about it. I know what they thought about it because it's what they published in the paper, which was that we're just crazy hippies, which is a little odd given Brian's particular punk rock look and aesthetic. But anyway,
I like hippies on toast.
It's been actually very interesting because along with people, you know, at the beginning, they also didn't understand the kind of beer we're making. Hmm. The only beer that was around at that point that was not a macro, a macro lager, was Okanagan Springs. And people just had no idea what we were trying to do. So as they adopted the beer and they started to come out and do tours of the farm and tours of the brewery, they started to kind of glom onto what we were doing. The rise of the concept of the 100-mile diet was part of actually people changing their minds and coming out and really going, Oh, I get it. You're actually trying to live with local, within your local footprint. Oh, that's what you meant.
I actually like to say too that we were working in community, which is really smacks in the face of that individualistic capitalist kind of model. They talk about the lone wolf, where they go off and do things by themselves, and they're super, super capitalists in that, and they're able to do things, where we had to introduce the concept of working in community and depending on each other and everybody being important in that village and us just being your friendly neighborhood brewer.
Yeah, and I think actually to add to that, Brian, it's really important that, you know, we're two people being interviewed here, but the entire community of organic farmers, of the brewing community, the people of this area are the people who make this happen. So
indeed,
I think it's really easy for us to fall into this idea of hero worship and individualism. And so I just want to sort of put in a plug for a counter view of that we've been given a microphone, kind of literally, but that's just happenstance, really. It's not that we are the heroes. The community are the people. This wide community of visionary people is what made all this happen.
And the idea about community is really important because this community isn't neighborhood based. It's actually, it encompasses a large geographic concept. And so we have a neighborhood here, but we don't necessarily have a community here.
The community is philosophically based rather than necessarily geographically
based. Indeed. And you also live in an era, all of us do, in an era when we can connect quite substantively with people who are geographically very far away, but in spirit or in the principles by which they live are very close to what you are doing on your farm. You can contact people, for example, in Ireland, Brian, or anywhere else in the world who think like you or who understand the principles that you're trying to operate your farm by. That must give you a certain sense of global solidarity at times.
Yes.
Yeah, it definitely does. I'd also like to say that's a pattern that, again, comes from our forebears. Both my parents were activists within an extremely extended global community, whether that was activism in the sense of libertarian theory, sorry, not libertarian, liberation, whoops, fairly significant difference there.
There's a
liberation
difference.
Theology. Oh, dear. Okay, so not to confuse our listeners, libertarians would be far-right individualists. Liberation theology is a way of looking at Christian theology as a socialist doctrine. So pretty far apart there.
Indeed.
Anyway, that part Brewster was working on. And again, their work on food systems analysis was very much part of the global Campesina movement.
Absolutely.
So not necessarily relying on the internet. You know, letters can also do it, and so can big conferences back when people could travel.
You're talking, infused in the comments you've made, the anti-libertarian comments, pro-liberation comments, is this notion of relationships and the value of relationships and the importance of relationships in not just promoting ideas, but also in building that sense of community. Your marketing ploy is to have people come to the farm and see what you're doing, as opposed to telling them in a slick ad in a upscale publication that we have all the best things you could possibly ever want in the world, come to our place or buy our product. You actually have people come on the land. What do you do when you have a farm tour? How do you make that work?
Well, basically, the brewery tour actually starts out with a tour of the farm, explaining how the farm and the brewery are integrated with each other. So how materials flow between one and the other, how work flows between one and the other. They get introduced to our compost pile because that
a
is
a very
of course,
sanguine great. Introduction, undoubtedly.
Absolutely. His name is Fred. He's very friendly. He'll grow on you. Sorry, it's way too early for that kind of commentary. Never mind.
It's just the right time. Just the right time, Rebecca.
And then they go, we take people into the brewery so they can see the size of the whole thing, the age of our equipment, the fact that we're not all shiny new with computerized everything. It's a very manual, which makes it a very sensory experience. Mm-hmm. Working in the brewery, it's a very physical thing.
I'd say, too, that as a really important part of that is that we show things. We don't cover up everything so that they can repeat certain concepts that we have that are very water conservatory. We have ways of working that we want people to repeat.
Mm-hmm. So we're trying to show people things that they can bring home with them and put into their own lives. And then after we've propagandized them for at least a half an hour, they finally get to have some beer.
I think that's a very wise sequence of events. If you want beer, you have to listen first. So if we're talking about relationships, there's all kinds of relationships, and farming is a very physical experience. Running a brewery, as you just said, Brian, is also a very physical experience. You don't just look at the big vat and say, well, I hope that works. You have to get right up and dump stuff into it. So you also have people who work on your farm, and the relationships you have with the people who work with you on the farm are also an important part and something you take seriously. Maybe you could describe a little bit about how you have an inclusive employment notion that's underlying what you do in that area.
Well, I can start off a little bit about, we try to have people here. We have a couple of programs on the go here. First of all, have people who stay here have heavily subsidized rent. And that's the idea that they would put a little bit of effort towards helping on the farm and or being part of it, not just helping, but being part of that farm. And also
eating from the farm.
Indeed.
So the idea with people who are working with the farm and the breweries, it's kind of everybody does a bit of everything, which keeps life interesting for all of us. And that's part of being, you know, a sustainable human is enjoying your life as you're going, not living for some future date when you can actually start to enjoy things. But the relationship is basically based on working together, feeding ourselves, not running anything at market rate for rent, because that's just profit taking. So it's essentially about making sure that our employees, where their employees and not farm partners, are also having enough. And again, making sure that that concept of enough is based in a personal sustainability, both ecologically in terms of health and economic sustainability. So if somebody's got, you know, an extraordinary expense of, you know, whether it's a health related thing or kids or someone else they're trying to support, that gets reflected in the kind of pay that they're getting from the brewery and the kind of food that we're trying to produce on the land.
On a larger note too, that we do grow and have more chickens that we need here, so that we share with community. And that goes with a concept of if you see a business having some sort of charity day and they say, we're going to give back to community. Well, we don't take in the first place. And so this is part of it. We just have a dispersal of things that we're doing already and making sure the larger community has access to food as well.
It's very interesting how hard large enterprises and corporate players, if we call them that, work to try and create that image of being engaged in the community. You buy shirts for a baseball team, or you support a local charity, and conspicuously support it. It's usually clear that your name goes on the document, or there's a check that's held up, you know, one of those big checks that you hold up. What you're actually doing is trying to make it concrete. In other words, specific people in specific circumstances, and giving to them what is specifically relevant to them, as opposed to a more generic, maybe somewhat more superficial engagement, which is more to do with public relations.
Yeah, we believe in helping people before they get into crisis, and not just pitching in when there's a crisis moment, because there's a lot of crisis that we can prevent from helping and sharing the resources and person power together before those elements happen.
Which I think also reflects, you know, what we pretty much figure is actually society's role and government's role, which is not to push people into poverty and you know, all of the things that come with that, and then throw some meager scraps at them and call that sufficient. If, you know, our role as society is actually to be supporting each other to be healthy in the first place, with all of the things that implies.
There's much talk these days about a guaranteed living wage or guaranteed basic income. It seems to me that in a very real way, what you're doing and actually accomplishing on the farm is setting up a guaranteed living wage but tailored to individuals, as what you're saying, Brian, about the preventive process. You're not waiting until people are in a crisis. You're trying to make sure that they have enough so they don't have to get into crisis. I, in my practice as a physician, I see people coming in often who are in crisis financially perpetually because they don't have the basic things they need, which is food, clothing, and shelter.
I would like to say something about the I don't necessarily agree with the guaranteed wage, only because I don't believe that we should continue this capitalism and having people take part in capitalism and commodify everything. I think it's important to make sure that we have certain things in society that is being taken care of, and it's food and shelter.
Yes,
I really feel the idea of real estate is really important. And I don't think that people should be in indentured servitude for the rest of their lives for their own shelter.
Yeah. So if you're basing your dollar value of a guaranteed basic income on rent in this area costs $1,300 right. for an SRO, a single room occupancy unit. And your food costs are based on eating expensive processed food, then you're not, this has nothing to do with actual what is required to live. And you're still actually supporting profit taking in particular by landlords, landowners, and also by the big food companies and all of those people that are creating profit within the system instead of actually trying to feed people.
So I propose that we knock out that guaranteed income and have guaranteed shelter and food.
That sounds very much more pragmatic. I haven't met a single person yet who said, well, I'm okay, I don't really need food, or I could just live out in a field somewhere. I'll be okay. Don't worry, it'll be fine. I mean, there are people who are compelled to do that, and occasionally, by some peculiar set of circumstances, they find that works for them in some respect. But the overwhelming majority of people, I think, would say food, maybe clothing as well, especially in the winter. Food,
and
clothing,
and
shelter.
Water.
Big part?
And water as well.
Water would be very nice. I think very few people say that they'd like to get by without water.
Well, it brings me into a slight point, a point, fine point, that we don't want to be self-reliant. We want to live in community. That's the point. There's these people who say, well, you could be completely on your own and you don't have to worry about outside influences. It says, no, we welcome the outside influences. We want to live in community. We want to be dependent on people, and we want to be dependable to people.
Two very important concepts that I think are closely interrelated, and all coming back to relationship and how you structure, how you shape relationships. Both of you, over many years, have thought a lot about the structures in our world, the way we as humans have set up institutions and processes that make the world, our world, our human world, work for us. They don't always work very well, and you're talking about refinements in those processes. Maybe we could spend a little time looking at how what you're doing can shape where food in the shoe swap and in other areas by modeling can be restructured to make it a more sovereign process. That's one of the principles that we explore on Food Conversations. How what you're doing gives an example of developing food sovereignty.
Ooh. I think there's a couple of critical pieces in there. One is reducing the distance in the food system, and the other is seasonal local supply. So they are really intertwined. So there's a lot of distance in the food system, whether that is the distance created by shipping food, whether we're eating pineapples or something as mundane, shall we say, as broccoli, which right now, if you're getting broccoli, you're getting it from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're talking the distance that is created by intervening in the food system in several places.
So instead of the middle people, as they call them.
The middle people, exactly. Whether they're shippers or processors, the more processed your food is, the more people, the more steps have been involved between where you're eating it and the farmer that actually grew the original ingredients.
Indeed.
And that distance does a bunch of things. In one very important respect, it inflates the price. And at the same time, it actually reduces the price to the farmer that is paid for that food.
Indeed.
Because the only way that our cheap food policy, which is a federally supported policy, can keep the food that we're purchasing now at the prices that it's at is by essentially driving down the price to the farmers. So we have farmers that are producing wheat for the same price, dollar for dollar, not even in counting inflation, that they were in the 1930s.
Indeed.
Now, how anybody's supposed to be making a living on that is beyond me.
And the profit margin, the net profit margin, is so small, as I'm sure you have often been aware, it's so small that if there's a slight shift in what is generally called commodity prices, then farms go bankrupt in waves.
Yeah, they absolutely do. And so that, I mean, it's clearly that is an unsustainable model. And so if we can start trying to figure out ways to reduce the distance in our food system, preferably by having more people able to buy directly from farmers, which is why farmers markets are such a brilliant concept, yes. Or CSA programs, all of the things that have been discussed previously in this program, those are ways of decreasing that, of increasing the margin that comes back to the farmers so they can make a living, but also decreasing that physical and philosophical distance in the food system.
Yeah, actually, that kind of brought me to a point that I was thinking about for the ideological mentorship of people in general. There's local knowledge and there's mentorship and solutions and ideas that you should be going to farmers and keeping them relevant for the knowledge that they have and not use Google to find your answers. Actually talk to people, the people who are languishing in places that no one bothers to ask their opinion on things. They have a wealth of knowledge in their noggins, and they really need to be able to talk to the younger generations in that and say, because they have a lot of information of things that work. When you Google something, you just find one solution, but you don't figure out what came before that and what's the result of it. And it leads you all sorts of problems. And it also, yeah, the relevancy of farmers as mentors is really important.
On this show, we often end up talking about relationships and connections between people, the distribution of ideas and concepts. And of course, we are now in the middle of an interesting time, another interesting time, with a 200 nanometer virus monitoring and monopolizing the news to the point of excluding a lot of information about a lot of other interesting things that we should be thinking about. Many people see the COVID situation as a potential learning experience for humanity, learning about some of the things that we've been talking about today, relationship, learning about what really matters, learning about what we need as opposed to what we want. And when you talk about, as we were just a moment ago, talking about the shortening of food distribution chains and networks and the removal of multiple steps between food being produced and food being eaten, that points to some new directions that we could be thinking about for future food production, food availability, and ultimately, of course, food sovereignty. Brian, from a sort of transatlantic perspective, from an Irish, you know, colonized experience perspective, and also from 21 years running a successful brewery / farm operation, where do you think things are going and where do you think they need to go in terms of how we do food, if you want to put it that way?
Well, I have to plagiarize on a little bit of Irish history as far as the famine is concerned, and I find it repeating itself on this side of the water, where you'd have exports of life-giving food at the time when they were coming out of Ireland, when the people were starving in Ireland and could have been eating that food. So, 1847 is Black 47 is when a lot of the potato crops had failed, and it was through it was just basically all their cash crops they couldn't eat anymore, and that seems to be repeating itself on this side of the water where the people are producing crops, but the farmers are going to food banks.
Yes,
and basically having their contracts being undercut by the likes of Walmart and places.
A further analogy to that, Brian, would be that at the time of the Irish potato famine, as it's called, Britain, right across the Irish Sea, withheld food resources from the Irish people. And that was a major factor precipitating the Irish diaspora. The food was clearly not going to be coming to them. Irish people had to leave their home country. We could replace Britain, perhaps, with food giants like Cargill, like Archer Midland Daniels, and see something similar if they can manipulate market forces. And there's no direct control over what they do exercised by people living in a community like Sorrento or Salmon Arm or in the Shuswap.
Yeah. That's very much the case. In terms of Ireland, you know, you had they were actually exporting grain. Ships leaving the country were crossing paths in the harbor. So ships leaving the country full of grain were crossing paths with ships full of food aid in the harbors, and then that food aid was not being allowed to land.
Yes,
and the criminalization of the population happened too. A lot of the people didn't voluntarily leave. They actually were transported because they were breaking into grain bins just to feed their families.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of thing that this kind of turmoil is to some degree something that's been, in this case, precipitated by a virus, but the virus is also probably among us because of human behavior. There's a lot of scientific research being done on that. So to build resiliency, to build autonomy, what kinds of steps do you see us taking, and what types of steps do you think we should make? Rebecca?
Well, I think, again, it's about reducing distance, increasing relationships, and most importantly, shifting back to smaller scale, localized production. Hmm. When you look at a region, a bioregion, and the kind of food that it can produce, it requires a shift from this mechanistic style of farming, this industrialized style of farming, and the export of commodities, the commodification of farming and food as it is. The system that we have is using food growing land for a variety of purposes, several of which are not even remotely related to growing food.
Indeed.
And a lot of which are involved, you know, whether it's corn that is actually grown for high fructose corn syrup and livestock feed for livestock that shouldn't be eating corn, for one thing, and for humans that should definitely not be eating high fructose corn syrup. If we can break down those systems into something that is based on a local bioregion. What does that mean? It means, for example, for one thing, back to something we talked about earlier, we need to shift our land ownership. We need to not be commodifying, especially agricultural land, because the commodification of that land drives up prices, makes it impossible for new people to get access to that system. But more importantly, what it actually does is it turns our food production at the very base into something that is monetized. That is essentially and incontrovertibly dealing in inequality and creating more inequality in our system.
Also, there's the notion of animal welfare and things within that. And that when we first started here, we had a group of people who would come up here with a mobile abattoir for our chickens. Shipping chickens, shipping beef, shipping pork is all very detrimental to the welfare of the animals, and we have to be a little bit more sensitive to the life forms that we're responsible for. And a few years after we had that system going, the powers that be in all their wisdom decided to shut them down, and then we had less food security.
So, yeah, so we need to be redeveloping those local systems. And I should put in a plug here. In fact, we have a really awesome Minister of Agriculture who's actually doing a lot of work to try to reintroduce some of those, some of that resiliency back into our local food system.
Probably because she used to be an organic farmer herself. Lana Popham ran an organic farm.
Yes, yeah, and she's certainly maintained that sensibility through all the work that she's been doing. I think the other piece of that is that as eaters, we need to be re-engaging in local production of food and re-engaging in our relationship to food as, again, not as a commodity, not as the Subway ads have it, as fuel, but actually as something that conveys culture and nutrients and beauty and joy. Because food can bring all of those things to us. And when we're engaging in shopping at farmers markets or our relationship, direct relationship with our own gardens, no matter how small they are, we're actually, again, learning that interdependence and that building a relationship both with people and with the land. And I think those are pieces that will serve us well in the future if we can continue to create that.
It's interesting how many social events are augmented in terms of their joy and satisfaction by having food. I mean, of course, having Crannog Ales beer, but having food as part of the celebration, or even just part of the educational experience, or part of the meeting for discussing what we do next as a group or as a community. Food really plays that significant role. Brian, in Irish culture, I'm sure food as part of a sort of social process has always been recognized as central, as it is in Indigenous culture.
Well, it's an island nation, so or it would be if Britain would just get the hell out. and we so fish is a big time, and a lot of people survived during that famine time on fish, and they were able to supplement their, or actually wouldn't supplement. I would say that's part of the mainstay of a lot of people's diet, at least on the coast. And so and I would just say back to your other point about sharing and solidarity. Every culture on the earth seems to be, it's the food part is part of the celebration. There's always feasts in every culture. So that's one way that we really have in common with everybody. And we really have to make sure that we're doing it together.
There's a little piece I'd like to throw in there that is something that I've not heard of anywhere else, which is in Ireland, you find every house has got a little bench outside the door. I was quite convinced that this was just to put your shoes on or take them off before you walked in muddy. Brian, let me know that, in fact, that is called a starvation bench. And it's there because the overriding cultural ethos, as it is in most Indigenous communities, is to feed each other, to feed the community. Mm-hmm. And if your landlord or someone else in the community are misbehaving, are depriving people of food and of community, you sit on the starvation bench outside their door and you go on hunger strike. and that is, it's visible to the community. It is sure. Very clear what the purpose is. And it's, so it's an intensely political act. When people, I just like to point this out too, that when people in Ireland went on hunger strike in the north, in the 70s and 80s, that was an extraordinarily powerful cultural statement because of this understanding of the centrality of food. It only works when that is the overriding and pervasive cultural understanding of food.
Yeah, you don't lightly go on a hunger strike because it's a fad or you want to have your point known. This is the only thing you have left to actually work with.
Yes, it's been used by a number of Indigenous leaders in this country for exactly that point, to make it clear that the issue that they're addressing is a serious issue. You've developed a feast, speaking of feasts, that is unique to your farm and your brewery. Maybe you could talk about your feast, your special feast. We have just
It's the 100-foot feast, and the concept behind it is that all of the food, or almost all the food, comes from 100 feet of the table.
Yeah, so it's a bit of tongue-in-cheek about the 100-mile diet. So we said, and really, it's a nod to farmers on how people live and in community, that we have to get back to the notion of we can survive on what is happening right around us. We don't have to supply ourselves with long-away grown food.
Yes, I think this, your laying out what you're doing has undoubtedly been an inspiration to listeners, the thoughtful farmers. Maybe that's a name you guys could take on, a sobriquet, because it does show that it's farming is not only complex, but its position in our world is important and essential to all of the things we do, not just eating, but also community relationships, gaining some sense of autonomy and resilience in communities. I want to thank both of you for being part of our show, and I certainly hope that the Feast of 100 Feet becomes something that everybody wants to do and will aspire to. Thank you very much, Brian McIsaac and Rebecca Neen.
Thank you very much.
So much, Brian.